everyone, and welcome to another exciting installment of Literary Loitering, yours and my favourite vaguely arts and books related podcast. Or at least that is the pretense we're going to keep up for at least one more week. I am Andrew, and as per usual, I'm joined by Graham.
Hello.
But as not per usual, I'm joined by no one else.
Hello. Sorry, that was that's conceptually difficult, isn't it?
It is. You've blown my mind. just imagine one of them is Graham and one of them is Graham, but with a fake moustache on.
Yes, that would do. I've always seen myself as a multi-character comedian in the vein of Peter Sellers.
So you are the man of at least two faces.
The man of one and a half voices.
Well, that seems like it's leading us into our first story.
It is, actually, yes. I've just noticed that. I'm just hurriedly reordering these because I've done an accidental segue.
Oh, no, I thought that was entirely deliberate.
I could have got away with it, couldn't I?
Right. Really, it's my fault for assuming we could do something competently. That's not on brand, silly Andrew.
Already kind of missing Rob and Sarah, aren't we?
What if it turns out they were the stabilising presence all along?
What if it turns out that Sarah was the stabilising presence during the time when she wasn't on the show? And even then, she was doing a better job than us.
I mean, she'd struggle to do a worse job.
Yes. But yes, this thing that we've accidentally got ourselves into is to do with Stuart Turton's new novel, The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle. Except, if you're in America, it isn't, because the novel has been released as The Seven and a Half Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle. Asked why, the US publisher Sourcebook simply said, "Our editorial team decided to supersize it."
And if you splash out an extra couple of dollars, it comes with a large fries and a Diet Coke.
It has prompted a piece by Tarina Bell on The Guardian's books blog about how often novels from around the world have their titles changed for American audiences. Obviously, there's Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, as it is in the States.
Which is insane.
Yeah.
That's not a thing.
It's a wizard looking for a stone belonging to wizards, which doesn't sound like much of an adventure to me.
Oh, just you wait till they find Dumbledore's pet rock.
With its little googly eyes and its stick-on beard.
Why do we keep making Harry Potter better, Graham?
I don't know. We could ruin it by sort of arbitrarily deciding that Dumbledore's pet rock was actually gay, but we're not going to mention that ever.
But also, please give me lots of Twitter likes.
Yes.
I mean, I never said that the rock wasn't black.
Some of these changed titles are insane. Good Wives by Louisa May Alcott was published as Little Women 2.
This time it's serious.
The Little Women in the Ink.
Too little, two women.
Oh, we found the best one. Yes. And also it mentions that Agatha Christie novel, which had a very positive change for the US market when they made the title less racist.
Which one's that? Because the Agatha Christie one I found is the amazingly pointless, changing murder in three acts to three-act tragedy.
Yes, that's pretty bad. I was thinking of And Then There Were None, which is generally published in the UK.
Oh, yeah. Under the name we definitely can't say on the show.
Yeah, that, yeah. It's probably aged slightly better, hasn't it?
Yeah, to be honest, that's one of those ones where I always forget that that isn't the original name. Possibly willfully.
It's for the best, isn't it? I did like that when it was first brought to her attention that the title was a bit racist, she decided to change it to 10 Little Indians, which, you know, completely vaults over that problem. So, yes, shall we move from one set of national stereotypes to another?
Yeah, why not?
Because the French have complained about the Renaudot Prize, which is a big deal in France, apparently. You can tell, because I haven't heard of it. They have complained about the winner being a self-published novel available only on Amazon. And the argument has been conducted in, it has to be said, the Frenchest way possible.
They smoked angrily. They've thrown their berries on the ground in disgust.
I've got two words for you. Baguette fencing.
What?
No, okay, I made that up.
Oh. That's just after hours.
Yeah, the author in question is Marco Koskis, who has written a book called Bande de France. It's very French already, isn't it?
So French.
And he was refused by every French publisher he reached out to, and he has said, possibly while drinking Chardonnay, "I didn't want to bow down to this decision. In the end, I decided to self-publish. Otherwise, I might have gone into some sort of literary hiding."
God, I don't think there is a more French way of saying, "No one wanted to buy my book, so I published it myself."
So he has laid down his cards on the table in this battle of Frenchness, and he
I think he is somehow just always in black and white.
Yes, quite possibly. He has subtitles floating around his chest. A group of French booksellers called the Syndicat de la Librairie Française, so French,
so very French,
have said, have objected to the fact that they cannot stock the prize-winning book, and have said, morally, above all, "We refuse to jump into the wolf's mouth."
It's so French, Graham.
And then there's a load of actually genuinely true stuff about Amazon eliminating its competitors and dodging tax. But let's face it, that's true wherever you are. Whereas comparing stocking an e-book to being eaten alive by the beast of Gévaudan is really French.
Oh, it's beautiful, Graham. Thank you for bringing this up.
It, at the risk of sincerity, it is quite an interesting thing, isn't it? Because I know our local Waterstones always has big displays of all the prize-winning books every time there's a major literary award. And it was probably inevitable that sooner or later there'd be one you wouldn't be able to stock.
Yeah, no, I think stripping away the fun, it is genuinely interesting.
Mm.
Just in the sense of looking at the way we've consumed media has rapidly changed. Just like in the past few years.
Yeah.
And how a lot of businesses maybe should look at the fact that they don't know how to adapt to this change in the market rather than just yelling, "It's all the millennials' fault."
But we're killing baked beans, Andrew.
Oh, no.
What's your favourite thing that you, as a millennial, are killing?
I think it's possibly the fact that I'm simultaneously killing the eating out experience and grocery shopping.
Yes. Yeah, what do millennials have against food?
It's that we can't afford it because the baby boomers destroyed the economy. All we can eat is styrofoam now.
I like that millennials have killed things like Hooters restaurant in America through not even trying. It's like it didn't need to be a major campaign. We just couldn't be bothered to go.
God, we're so cruel and indifferent.
Our apathy is worth like 50 actual campaigns. Take that, my old PE teacher.
Yeah, that's all we needed to do to kill a franchise was decide, actually, it looks quite skeezy and the food probably isn't great.
Can't imagine a place that is actually called Hooters would have, like, incredible standards of food preparation.
seems like a really not the best idea to hang your entire hat on of just look boobies.
It did. Hooters has given us one great thing, though. One of its former employees is the actress Amy Adams.
And just saying she never would have got her big break if not for Hooters.
If it wasn't for Hooters. There's probably some drunk dad somewhere who's just thinking, that waitress whose waps I was staring at for full uninterrupted 10 minutes while I pretended I couldn't think of something to order, she's got 5 Oscar nominations.
You don't know that. I'll rescind my earlier point. I think Hooters is entirely to thank. Because I feel like what once you're there at that point, that you have to work at a glorified strip club. You probably do think, you know what the hell, I will give acting a shot.
Yes, and my God, I'd better be good at it or I'll land back here.
I mean, that's the real secret to being a billionaire.
Yeah, maybe I haven't worked at enough terrible places to be rich. Hey, yo, speaking of utterly terrible early conditions in a fellow's life, we have found some details on what might have inspired William Shakespeare.
Is it that he got into some kind of situation which coincidentally happened to resemble the play he would later write, but also bore lots of resemblance to situations that we struggle through in the modern day, and then he turned to camera and said, well, boy, I sure hope it isn't like this in the future. A wink.
Are you Ben Elton?
Yes, I have described literally every episode of Upstart Crow.
No, of course I'm referring to the day when he became the Earl of Oxford secretly. No, I'm not even doing that.
No, don't, because there will be people who believe it's true.
There are. Roland Emmerich made a hilariously bad movie about this.
That's right, he did!
It was so full of nonsense that the Oxfordian Society, who exists to promote the Earl of Oxford conspiracy theory, issued a statement distancing themselves from what they described as its unfounded speculation.
Oh, it's like a delicious irony cake. No, sir, we will not stand for this balderdash, they said, whilst angrily adjusting their tinfoil hats.
No. This refers to some discoveries by Professor Glyn Parry about Shakespeare's entrepreneur father John, who had been informed on by citizen informants who were apparently, quite a big thing in Elizabethan England, that he had been accused repeatedly of, and I swear to God this is a quote, illegal money lending and woe dealing.
And woe dealing. Like, he just had a van full of Bill and Ted's.
No, that would be much less stupid. It was wool dealing. Dealing of sheep's wool.
Illegal wool dealing.
It's like the crappiest remake of Scarface.
I mean, I'm imagining more just only fools and horses.
Yes. I'm just imagining them now shearing sheep in that little Peckham flat, and it's good, actually. Why did John Sullivan not do that?
I don't know, probably in David Jason's contract. He's notoriously racist against sheep.
Yes. He describes them as sheeple. It's so cruel. But yes, so there were multiple writs issued against John Shakespeare, which sounds like a stupid joke name I've made up, but that was actually his father's name, and record debts of up to £132, which is around 20 grand today. So basically, if Shakespeare had lived today and got a university education, his situation would be about the same.
See, on the one hand, that's a very grim and depressing thought. But on the other hand, so basically what you're saying is that William Shakespeare grew up in debt and poverty, trying to support a family that made some poor decisions using his mastery of words, wordplay.
Yeah.
AKA the plot of 8 Mile.
Now that's a remake I'd like to see.
What are you doing, Ben Elton? We are just spinning gold here like John Shakespeare and his illegal sheep farm.
Yes. It'd be worth the whole project just for the gritty scene when Shakespeare hits rock bottom and becomes a Hooters waitress.
Yes.
Thereby inspiring all of those cross-dressing farces he would write. It's quite eerie how well this is coming together.
This is worryingly all tied together too well.
Yes, unfortunately, Shakespeare's legacy is not all feel-good, wool-stealing shenanigans even today. There is news that Iran has detained two people over production of A Midsummer Night's Dream, which was promoted with a trailer where two people of different genders could be seen dancing with each other.
That's insane.
Yeah. I mean, you would think that Iran would have enough problems with the Shakespeare play where the lady has sex with a horse anyway.
Yeah, yeah, that they are. That's an odd hill to die on.
A bit selective in their outrage.
Mm. Do you think the Iranian government thought that Footloose was a tragedy?
Yes. Quite possibly, yeah. Of course, in Shakespeare's day, all of the female roles would have been played by men dressed as women, so maybe that would be more acceptable to the Islamic Republic of Iran?
I feel like the answer to that is both widely known and horribly depressing.
Shall we clear away another widely known and horribly depressing story before we get on to some fun stuff towards the end?
God, that could be anything in the show. It's just a cavalcade of horror that we've got tucked away.
For once, the fun stuff is to do with politics, which I'm not quite used to. But before we clear that up, we have news that the New York Review of Books has won a coveted award.
Is it the, oh my Jesus Christ, what are you doing? Stop it now. No, please stop it. Don't do this award.
It is, yes, which are words that will probably be very familiar to its author, the prominent broadcaster and sexual assaulter, Gian Gomeshi.
Oh, Graham.
You know what you did.
I didn't. For once, I didn't. Oh.
Yes, the New York Review of Books has published a story called Reflections on a Hashtag, which, to me, the title alone is call for immediate execution of the magazine's entire staff.
It's just cancel the concept of press, I think. Just go back in time. Go back to when the first King James Bible is about to be printed on the first printing press and just say, no, nah, just, it's not worth it.
You're going into this with good intentions, but we've seen how it works out. But yes. Reflections on a Hashtag is written by Gian Gomeshi, who was a widely beloved radio host in Canada until all of that stuff about him sexually harassing people and punching his girlfriends on a first date came out.
But Graham, he was acquitted, so it must not be true.
God, sorry, I forgot.
I think my eyes might have rolled so hard they're now lodged in the back of my brain.
I mean, certainly coming from Britain, it's hard to think of a person who has escaped justice for horrible sexual crimes because he was a famous broadcaster. So, yep, this story checks out. What is kind of staggering me is that they have decided to compound this problem by giving the October issue of the magazine the worst title. It is called The Fall of Men.
Which just... Jesus Christ, New York Review of Books, read the room.
We fell over, Andrew. You might not know it yet. I'm picturing it as being kind of like those old bits on Vic Reeves' Big Night Out where Bob Mortimer would just sort of slowly descend to the floor and go, oh, Vic, I've fallen.
We've fallen, but just onto a different point of the mountain that we are still very much on the top of.
Yes.
The mountain made up of all the crushed bodies of women and minorities.
We are the mountain goats on the Andes of molestation. So I would say that if men truly have fallen, it would be quite hard for men with an extremely sketchy history who nobody likes to continue to get prestigious publishing deals in major literary magazines. And yet here we are.
Yeah, that's... But unless it's like some really high-level game that just the sheer hypocrisy of this is going to like implode in itself. Maybe sucking Gomeshi in with it? Just crushing him down into a lump of dark matter? By which I mean maybe the literal turd that he is?
The piece is described on the cover as Gian Gomeshi on Gian Gomeshi, which gives you a positive hope that he might have found a partner he respects at last.
I want to find every single copy of this magazine and just vomit on it. Possibly whilst maintaining eye contact with Gian Gomeshi.
Yes. The quote that has been given is just so bad. It says, one of my female friends... Yeah, okay, go with it. One of my female friends quips that I should get some kind of public recognition as a Me Too pioneer. There are lots of guys more hated than me now, but I was the guy everyone hated first. Because he punched his girlfriend in the throat.
Oh, I want to shove his face into a belt sander.
One minor insight into how rubbish like this actually happens might be given by a series of backstage ructions at Harper's Monthly, which is a magazine that's been going for 150 years and for most of them has been basically good. I used to have a subscription to Harper's. I didn't let it lapse because of this. I let it lapse because they kept hassling me about renewing my subscription so much they just got on my wires. But I'm kind of glad that I was so petty now, because their current publisher, John R. MacArthur, who has managed to fire three editors by now, where maybe the problem isn't the editors,
damn it, editors, stop telling me this bad idea is a bad idea.
It was literally that. He said that he wanted to write a contrarian piece on the Me Too movement, and he was gifted the contrarian piece he wanted by Katie Royf, who was, I think, outside the door panhandling, saying, "Will be offensive for money." But that's kind of... Maybe I'm too innocent about how the magazine industry works, but I think you should probably decide the conclusion of an article after the research has been done.
Oh, Graham. Sweet cherub like Graham. I think somewhere Katie Hopkins has just burst out into a horrific cackling laugh.
Oh, at times like this, you just want to move back into a more innocent time, don't you?
Please don't say it like the 90s, Graham.
A time, if you will, like the 90s.
Oh, Graham, no. I've changed my mind. We shouldn't do this story, Graham. It's too bad. It's too bad a story.
Listeners, if that hasn't made you excited, I don't know what it is. There has been a historical reenactment of one of the signal events of the 1990s in Britain. It is a recreation by Chris Petit and Jonathan Meads of the funeral of Princess Diana.
And everyone was chill about it.
Yes, the tabloids have been quoted in this article as saying Princess Diana to be exorcised. That's how tabloids sound when they go into capitals. In sick and twisted funeral reenactment.
Do you know what? That actually reminds me. One time there was very almost an X-Men comic in which spin-off X-Men group Ecstatics is joined by a new member. That member being Princess Diana's ghost.
Oh God, I remember that.
Yeah, it's crazy because it was like literally at the last minute someone just said, wait, hold on, no, we can't do this at all. So, but they still ran the story just with this woman who is very obviously Princess Diana, but called like Schminces my nana.
Yes.
And that was still less offensive than this.
The paper has quoted Charlie Proctor, editor of a website called Royal Central. Now, go on, have a guess what his take on this would be.
Well, I think he took the popular position these days of just being a centrist. Just saying, yeah, you know, I might not agree with it, but it's right to expression and all that, isn't it?
I mean, the tabloids lean conservative, of course, and the conservatives are very keen that we preserve free expression from the snowflakes and not ban things just because they're offensive. And yet...
We only meant that when it's just talking about how good a woman's knocks are.
Yes. Maybe if they'd incorporated that into the funeral, that would have been inoffensive.
If all the people carrying the funeral were Hooters waitresses.
Of all of the things that I thought would become a running reference on when I started recording this show, Hooters was probably about 12th on the list, to be honest.
And yet here we are.
Yes, Proctor is quoted as saying, whether you're a monarchist or a republican, some events should be beyond humour, and the funeral of Princess Diana is one thing no one should be laughing at. It's not quite clear that people are laughing at this exactly.
I just don't understand why you would want to do this.
Can I be honest? I would probably attend this.
God, I would attend it as well.
Yeah. I think, you know, my...
Just because it's going to be... Nah, I'm going to say it anyway. But yeah, I'd be interested to watch it because I think it would be an absolute car crash.
Oh, God! Charlie Proctor, editor of the website...
Surprise, we're down here as well. We're all in the gutter.
He has denounced Andrew in a fierce press release. Oh dear God. I was thinking about cultural depictions of Diana, and there haven't been many. Obviously, the masterpiece is Naomi Watts in the film Diana.
But how dare you? You can't talk about the people's princess, literal Saint Diana, like that.
And yet quite a lot of people have, haven't they? I'm thinking in particular here of that amazing bit in Hilary Mantel's novel Beyond Black, where the main character, Alison, a medium, conjures up the spirit of Princess Diana, who says something like, and give my love to the kids, I forgot their names.
I for one, am shocked and offended that Hilary Mantel could dare suggest that someone whose defining trait was being slightly less rich than all the other rich people she was with might not actually have been, you know, like the living saint we make her out to be. I guess not living saint.
Well, yes, she's lost one major qualification for the post. Yeah, you don't expect.
Oh, has she?
Well, not according to X-Men. But yeah, you don't expect that kind of thing from Hilary Mantel, except for all of the occasions when she's done something like that.
I think it's fine. I think what we do is we just reimagine everything she's written in the voice of Mark Rylance, and suddenly it doesn't seem so bad.
Maybe that's it.
It's just calm and folksy.
She did. There was a big profile of her in the New Yorker ages ago, and she said that one of the things that sort of changed in her life was that when she was young, she was very thin, and everyone thought she was really cold and standoffish, and now she's old and she's quite fat, so everyone thinks she's harmless and jolly. So I feel like she's using it as a protective shield to go around saying fairly offensive things and having everyone go, oh, look at her little chubby cheeks, like she's a goddamn chipmunk or something.
God, I really hope she is, because more power to her if she is.
Yeah, I love Hilary Mantel. So, just before we go on to our last story, which is hilarious, by the way, the big literary release of this week is, unfortunately, one of those incredibly long memoirs by Karl Ove Nausgaard.
I mean, it's fine. People are probably building houses with them.
Yes. The upmarket Fort Pedal Smut.
Yeah. But just look at this. That's not a man who... Or maybe he is a man who pedals smut.
Yes.
It's quite a scraggly beard.
He does. And his novels are full of details about him that I wish I'd never found out. But the question remains, this is a fairly obscure Norwegian author who has just published a 1,168-page memoir that is itself, like, what, the fourth, the fifth in his series of incredibly boring memoirs? And people are justifiably asking, where the hell is the editor in all of this? Well, Nausgaard said, I'm reading this from Private Eye, by the way. Nausgaard said in a recent interview that he spends half of his life in London, living with a fiancé who works as in publishing. A recent joint appearance after a reading confirmed the trade rumour that this is Mikael Shavit, publishing director of Cape, the sister imprint of Havel Secker, which also publishes the work of Karl Ove Nausgaard.
Nah. This just might be me. That does seem like a teensy tiny conflict of interest.
I mean, the work of Nausgaard is so acclaimed. Zadie Smith likes him, and who could doubt the word of Zadie Teeth, that obviously any suggestion that these books are only so full of faff because he is sleeping with an editor at the publishing company is obviously libelous, so we can't say that.
No, and we wouldn't dare.
So the last story is from The Guardian, and I'm going to make an unusual decision to read out the whole thing, because it's great.
Please do.
The full extent of senior Liberal Democrats' exasperation with their former leader Tim Farron's handling of questions about homosexuality and abortion will be revealed in a book about last year's general election. Philip Cowley and Dennis Kavanagh's The British General Election of 2017, the latest in a long-running series, will be published by Palgrave Macmillan on 27th September. It details the meltdown at Lib Dem HQ when a campaign the party had hoped would be about blocking Brexit became increasingly hijacked by the personal views of Farron, a Christian with conservative beliefs who resigned after the campaign, saying he had struggled to reconcile politics with remaining faithful to Christ. As the Lib Dems prepare to gather for their annual conference, extracts released to The Guardian recall Farron clashing with advisers over the issue of abortion as they prepped him for a televised debate. Now, here's the first lengthy quote, and it is just brilliant. Farron was asked a question about whether abortion was morally wrong, at which point he started to equivocate. The former Clegg advisor James McGrory was playing Paul Nuttall. He had a great time and made a much more effective Paul Nuttall than the real Paul Nuttall.
that's good.
But at this point, he broke out of character and exploded, For f**k's sake, you just say no. It's not f**king wrong.
Oh, Tim Farron.
This sounds much better than the actual leaders debate, doesn't it? Maybe they should transmit this.
They definitely should.
On homosexuality, advisors repeatedly attempted to, quote, come up with forms of words that he would be willing to say and which would resolve the issue, Cowley and Kavanagh write, only for Farron to change his mind, usually after attending his evangelical church. He'd travel back to Westmoreland, where things were not going well, and he'd go to church and realise how much they mattered to him and how much it mattered to them, and he'd come back down to London on Monday, and everything we thought we'd agreed would have unravelled, one tells the authors.
You know what? I've changed my mind. I think they shouldn't show this. Because if they did, it would be putting Armando Iannucci out of a job.
Yes. I love the idea that Farron's campaign was based on going to church and thinking, pretty much everyone else hates me. Maybe I should stick in with this lot.
Just go big or go home. And in that circumstance, you should definitely just go home.
Yes, please, God, go home.
Just quit while you're so very behind.
Farron had high hopes that Labour's decision to accept the results of the Brexit referendum, after which Jeremy Corbyn whipped his MPs to back Article 50. Overseas listeners, it's a parliamentary term, okay? It doesn't mean what you think.
As far as we know.
Would allow the Lib Dems to surge ahead in the polls and perhaps even to, quote, do a Trudeau and leapfrog the opposition. Everything in this sounds like some weird sex thing. Fancy leapfrogging the opposition with me later tonight, baby? If you're feeling limber, we can even do a Trudeau.
I'm afraid I can't. The party leader wants us in for a good whipping.
But by the closing stage of the campaign, focus groups carried out with putative Lib Dem voters, the only thing that got mentioned was homosexuality, one of those who organised the groups told Cowley and Kavanagh. People said, that doesn't sound very liberal, and you wanted to scream. So yes, it goes on like this in some detail, but what you may be wondering here, listeners, is what did Farron think in the middle of all this maelstrom? Fortunately, we have some details. Concerns, and if anything makes the sheer petty silliness of British politics clear, it is this at a time of national crisis. Concerns about whether Westmoreland and Lonsdale could be at risk also complicated the travel arrangements for the party's bright yellow battle bus.
It sounds like the most Mad Max thing ever. It's not. It's just a big dumb bus with a lie on the side.
You'd absolutely vote for a party who had a proper armoured battle bus with gun turrets, wouldn't you?
Yes. The politicians who had the courage to wear their leather outside of the personal chambers.
Yes, while not being whipped. Farron believed that one reason he was doing badly locally was that local voters saw him as having deserted them to go and be a big name politician in London. Like, no risk of that, Tim.
No, sorry, Tim. You're the leader of the Lib Dems? Silly Tim, forgetting which party he's part of.
He therefore did not want to be seen in the campaign bus going into or out of the constituency, so the party had to arrange for the bus to stop outside the constituency boundary, at which point he was transferred into a car.
That's madness, Graham.
They had to give him a lift to the bus. In case people thought he, people who, I mean, I've never been to Westmorland and Lonsdale, but I assume it's not that backwards. I assume they have televisions. I assume they're not switching on the news every night and seeing, you know, Lib Dem leader goes to the hustings in Glasgow and thinking, that's strange. I saw him in a car today. Can't have... No.
I just assume they're all the cast of The Wicker Man.
Yes. I think the cast of The Wicker Man are the last remaining Liberal Democrat MPs too, aren't they?
Oh, it's definitely.
So I absolutely love this story and am very eager to read this book. There's already been a book about the 2017 election by Tim Shipman, and Shipman is very good at the conservative side of things, but has few contacts in other parties. So it's nice to see how hilarious some of the other campaigns were as well.
Tim sounds like a terrible, awful man. But I love how his appointment was just basically Nick Clegg saying, well, seems like our party's in a bit of a rough spot, but at least things can't get worse. There's Tim Farron rolling up his sleeves saying, oh, really? Hold my beer.
The weird thing about Tim Farron is when it first became obvious that he was a bit evangelical, there were a lot of people prepared to give him the benefit of the doubt and said that he's made it clear that his personal beliefs will not affect how he governs, which I think, you know, people might have had misgivings, but that's a fair enough argument. After which he never shut up about homosexuality, and he still hasn't. He actually skipped out on a recent debate about giving people a final say on the Brexit vote because he wanted to go off and ramble about gay people some more. I just thought, for someone who doesn't want this to be an issue, I don't want it to be an issue. I would sooner forget Tim Farron was ever leader of the Liberal Democrats, but he keeps reminding me.
I mean, I think maybe he's like seen Donald Trump and just said, no, wait, it's okay. I just need to start saying really awful things and people will love me again.
It is quite a blessed relief, isn't it, to have a story about British politics which involves a book even more embarrassing than Omarosa's memoir. That was good stuff.
That was very good stuff.
Yes. A+ the Liberal Democrats, and I'm not sure I've said that since 2010.
I don't think they'll know what to do with an A+.
They'll stick it on their fridge. But yes, with that, we bid you adieu. This has been a slimmed down, but I think no less chaotic and poorly managed literary loitering than usual.
It's exactly. It's all the anarchy for half the price.
Exactly, yes. And since you're getting it free, that technically means we're giving you money.
I feel like I haven't thought this through.
Yeah, we're not doing that. So yes, until next time.
Burn the show, Graham, burn the show and run.
Until next time, you can listen to us on iTunes, Audio Boom and Stitcher. We are part of Geek Show's podcast network, so if you pop over to thegeekshow.co.uk, you can find a full archive of our podcasts, as well as lots of lovely swag and t-shirts and bags and things. But until next time, when we'll be back with stuff that's like that, but different stories, probably. That's been your lot from Literary Loitering. I've been Graham.
And I've been Andrew.
See you next week.
Thanks for listening.